Briefing on why we are here today. You are aware that last year we started this workshop whereby we called the academics to come and talk to us as to what is that they think about the national minimum wage. And we also called some business associations to come and talk to us as well, that we hear what is that they think. And after that, we went around to different provinces, meeting workers, different sectors of workers, to give them an opportunity to talk to us as to what is that they think this minimum wage should be, and questions and many other things that they think of, so that when the time comes that the process is concluded, everybody, more especially our stakeholders, would have said something. We deliberately did not focus earlier on employers, small business, because they are part of employers, no matter how small quantity of workers they have, but they feel employers, and the second on at the beginning. Now this process is for the business people, it's for SMEs, it's for trade unions to come and talk to us. We decided that you are the last ones because this is the, we are at the end, almost at the end of the process. And it gives us an advantage because we would have spoken to your constituencies and we know what is that they think. Now, talking to you, we will be talking to you as well because everybody in the process must not be left aside. I do know that people get confused, more especially business, the social partners of business, where you have community, you have trade unions, they get confused that they think that this is a duplication. It is not a duplication because Parliament does have its own voice, and the process is being conducted in network. Though it's headed by the Deputy President of the country, as the President has spoken, but it is not done in presidency, it is done through NEDLAC. And NEDLAC is an entity of the Department of Labor. NEDLAC reports to Parliament. Department of Labor reports to Parliament, to this committee. So at the end of all this process, together with NEDLAC, whatever program, whatever product that will come out of at the end of the day, it will be a product that both NEDLAC and Parliament have spoken to. So that's why we don't want you to say, no, this is what we have said to NEDLAC. We did not have, Parliament did not hear. So we, this process is not a fruitless exercise. It is an exercise that is necessary to take place. So those words, I will give over to Priscilla to talk. Something very important that you must not forget. It's something that we have said to workers as we're going around, that whatever you say here, it does not mean that we are going to take that route. You may take a little bit of what I'm saying and add, because all of you, you have different views. Imagine if all these workers were talking to us, different sectors of workers, we will never come up the road. So the process is for us to listen as much as possible. And at the end of the day, we take into account all these things that we have said and then come up with a product that we think will be a product that is realistic, that is informed by all the stakeholders. And we know that there will be those who will not be happy, but however, we would have given everybody an opportunity to speak. Thank you so much. Over to you, Sasawa.
Good morning, everybody.
Monique, I thank you for the opportunity to be here today, even often that this is domestic workers having the opportunity to address Parliament. I think that what you said makes sense. We are aware of the fact that what we are putting forward here won't obviously, or we hope that it will make an impact on the discussion moving forward. I think that I'm not the person really that likes to speak from paper. I'm normally the person that speaks whatever is in my heart, but I'll try my best to speak to the paper in front of me. I think that since the beginning of slavery, domestic work has been the worst form of exploitation of mainly women in South Africa. And then we should not forget that workers were controlled by the Master and Servants Act that rendered these workers powerless and with no voice. After many consultations and submissions, in the year 2002, a new minimum wage was set for the domestic work sector. Although this wage was very low, we had to take in consideration that domestic workers were already earning a very low salary, so we had to take it in stages. If we look today at the domestic workers' salary of about 2,067 rand, which still does not enable them to live a decent life. An example of the expenses are housing, electricity, school fees, food, clothing, traveling to work, traveling for children to school, medical. Minimum requirement should be about 4,750, that is just the minimum requirement. This does not account for any luxuries or extra for their children. This only describes the hand-to-mouth living, and most of the time, domestic workers live from borrowing money from national security over. Looking at the national minimum wage, Tatao is in favor of discussing this as domestic workers should be able to have a decent wage to provide a decent life for their family. But when we do this, we also have to bear in mind the current situation in our country, the unemployment levels, the economic crisis, job loss. But even this should not prevent us from seeking a living wage for all. Recently, there was a very interesting article in a newspaper where many housewives discussed that they are worth about, there's an area, they say they were worth about 30,000 rand a month for being a housewife. In South Africa, most of the work is done by domestic workers. Yet, when it comes to discussing the domestic workers, they will never even go over the 1,000 mark. Looking at the situation in our country, it is a domestic worker that is doing all the work. A national wage will surely provide a better life for the domestic workers, and even workers in other industries where salaries are as low. Based on our example below, a minimum of no less than 5,000 or even more will surely to begin to make a difference in our people's quality of life. However, I would like to add here that, you know, traveling a lot as a domestic worker speak now and looking at minimum wages in other countries, I think we should clearly have a good discussion about it. If we have a minimum wage, a national minimum wage for domestic workers, what is the status that we're going to take it through for employers to understand? Like when we have a minimum basic wage for domestic workers, many employers already threaten, I'm going to dismiss my worker, I cannot afford to pay her anymore. We know that is the argument that will always happen as soon as we speak about a decent wage for domestic workers. But we think surely if we can do this discussion properly, and if many people will air their voices, I'm sure that slowly but surely we can build it up to a national minimum wage, and domestic workers will be able to live a better life and to provide for their family. I thank you all.
Thank you, Paul. I will appeal to the members that we take, I don't know whether we wish to discuss, because really there is nothing much for us to discuss, but we are not stopping those that who are in the house to ask clarity. And I think members as well will be given that opportunity to ask clarity, not questions, because our role here is to listen to what you said. Honorable Bakri, did you have something different to say?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, just and it is a type of clarity in the sense that I want to make a remark and maybe the presenter can help us with this. It has been said that if in fact the country does implement a minimum wage, the litmus, the acid test will be what are the lowest workers in the community earning. And it is in fact, and I think it's fortuitous that we have domestic workers here today. And I thank them for this because they will probably set the baseline, domestic workers, because they are the lowest paid workers in the economy. And it's notoriously so that domestic workers are the most exploited workers in the country. And they have set that minimum wage already. The Department of Labour has set, through our Minister of Labour, has set a wage. And that wage in particular was set at a really careful level. The Minister put a lot of thought and effort into it. At a very careful level to ensure that domestic workers didn't lose their jobs because of that minimum wage. And that would probably be the level, and I just want this presenter to comment on it. I know I've spoken to the presenter before on many occasions, and maybe that comment should come out that we should hear, because their position in society is vital with regard to minimum wage. Thank you for that opportunity, Madam Chair. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Members, anyone, any clarity from your side? I will appeal to members that as you make your... I really don't want input from members, because whatever you say here, we are going to be responsible for it. Remember that as Parliament, we have not yet come to a stage where we say this is the route that must be taken. So all I expected from you, or I'm expecting from you, is to ask clarity. Because if you start by saying it will be better if you go in this way, we are still in that process of looking at modalities. And the modalities among other things that will assist us to get the right ones is to talk to stakeholders. And this is the opportunity that I'm giving to them. So as we talk, let us be careful of putting us in a threat of being quoted head and said, this is what you said in Parliament. Members, anybody who needs to want to make clarity, Honorable America?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the presentation, you have stated and there is a neat breakdown on the components that you think would make up, you suggest as the minimum wage. So my question for clarity, Madam Chair, is that these figures are based on workers who do not live in, or those who are living workers, because if we take some of those figures out, we would then closely, not closely, that close, but in the figure that I arrive at, it's not very high here. If you say that this figure here that you represent is a person who live in, then I'd like to know the difference, because if I take housing out and travelling to work, and then the figure then comes to 2,950, so I on that clarity. Thank you.
Seek for clarity, members from the public, you can. But if there's none, we will give over to Sasau to just say something on what you throw in front of you.
Yeah, I think that's a question, actually a very good question.
For many years we have been fighting the difference in wages for domestic workers because of the fact that, half our domestic workers is living in the backyard of the employer. But what we noticed over the last few years since 1994, that a lot of blessings are changing. And what we find is that domestic workers that is sleeping on the premises, employers is now actually charging them 10% to pay for the room. We also find out now that employers, instead of providing meals for them, is now giving them allowance to buy their own food. Although we don't really like it because employers is maybe giving them less than what, you know, the food is worth. So what we tried to do, we were looking at the national wage and we were trying to bring both workers to the same level. And with due respect, we also know that what we were looking at the later stage is where we were talking about a subsidy, a travel subsidy for those workers that will be coming in. So that is a separate issue that we will address in the future. But as a national minimum wage, we feel that it's not sufficient, but at least it will bring the domestic workers up to a better start in life. And that is why. And I also think that it was not so much that we were looking at domestic workers losing their jobs, because we know in South Africa that employers are still very much in, you know, use domestic workers. We are just saying we need to be careful, but we're not rejecting it. We say slowly but surely, domestic workers even need higher wage. So that was our response. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Honorable Lollywood. And Chair, I want to double check if my understanding of the concept is correct. To me, here you have not given us a scenario of what is supposed to be a salary. It's just an example. So there's no need to come with those who live in or what. Because it's not a scenario. If you are giving us an option to say this is option one, this is option two, to me you have just randomly thought of expenses. So if my understanding is correct, I just wanted to double check with you so that as we go back as the committee, we don't say you have tabled your proposal. This is not a proposal. It's just a random example. So that we don't view it as your option. Am I right?
I think that was just, we had a meeting and we were just discussing this. And some of the concerns were from the domestic workers. Yes, you can go up to 10,000, yes, but let us just basically, because as you say, this is just the beginning. So there will be more opportunities for us to discuss and see what other people comment. So there will be, there could have been 10 such documents here today. We could have had that, but we still want to do the introduction and say yes, but afterwards there will be much more discussions around our issues.
Thank you so much. If there are no further clarity-seeking questions, we will then pass to a second presenter, and that is Mamia Travel Tours. Are they here? Okay.
Good day, everybody. Thank you, Secretary, with your chairperson. My name is Kai from Mamia Travel Tours, based in Tourism, as a tour operator offering all tourism services in Cape Town and other provinces. My presentation will be based on observation that I have realized when I'm traveling to Johannesburg, Cape Town and other provinces in relation to the Employment Equity Act. Number 55 of 1998. My aim of this space ground is non-discrimination at the workplace, race, gender, and sex. The facts. I do not deny that the trade union movement has achieved enormous gains in achievement, e.g., highlighting the recognition of Labor Relations Act. 66 of 1996. Compliance. What I observe, companies like Greyhound, Intercape, Eldos, Skywise, Low Cost Airlines, SafeAir, are not complying with the Employment Equity Act. They are, I'm sorry to say this, but I must say it, they are only playing the colors, especially in Cape Town, in the power companies. If it is so, it's in line with the Job Reservation Act, the eight rituals revealed before the adoption of the new constitution. Recommendation. The Labour Committee will have to deal with these matters and need to intervene, therefore. I would like to thank the Labour Committee, the Portfolio Committee, by giving us the opportunity to attend the workshop. Drawing point of clarity and questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Short and straight to the point. Members, clarity seeking questions. Honorable Patrick. Sorry, Honorable America.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think listening to and reading through this submission, and respectfully, would like to say to the presenter that today's engagement is not about the Employment Equity Act, and unfortunately, we're deliberating on the minimum wages, and perhaps at another time in the future, we will possibly be able to engage on the content of this particular submission. But perhaps if there is specific issues that the presenter has with regard to the matters raised, the presenter could forward that to the committee for further investigation and possible action. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I just wanted to check with Mr. Ndumbeni whether is it possible for him at this stage to share with us at what level are people in the travel and tour industry paid and what is their proposal, so that he does not forfeit this opportunity of sharing that information with the community. My understanding is you are in Mamia Travel Tour. There are other people in the travel tour industry, and there's a particular salary that is paid to people who are working there. And I understand you may have different groups, you may have drivers, you may have also other assistants in buses and all that. What is your proposal of the salary that needs to be paid to people in that industry?
Thank you, member. I think in terms of the tourism, the salaries have got different sectors. For example, if you are a tour guide, a tour guide is based on daily, wage. And then also the driver, it could be you got outsourced driver, you also pay daily. That is why actually maybe there are some of them who are permanent. And permanent is entirely up to the company. Which company are you working for?
Thank you. The lady from Sasao?
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit confused here. I do understand what Vlad said, but I think it would have been very good if we would have had an understanding of what is really happening in the town and things like that. Because, just the example, like yesterday I traveled with two taxis. One taxi asked me 9 rand, the other taxi charged me 50 rand because he doesn't get the wage. So I think it would have been very interesting if we had more information on it. Even for our own organizations, it would have been very good. So it just leaves a blank thing in our minds on what we really wanted to put forward here today. Because this is about job equity or things like that. It's not really about the minimum wage. Thank you.
I just want to add from the question that was asked by my colleague. You see, it is not going to be easy for us. But I must say, you will not be making it easy for us to take a decision. If
you just throw figures and say this is so much that must be paid. Because we cannot assume, we don't know how you came to that figure. So that is why it is important that those who are coming up with figures, then they must motivate and tell us why do they think that is the figure. We must not ask you whether in that figure, what is included in that figure, because remember when Sasa was presented, there was a question that was saying what is included in that. So make things easy for us that when you arrive or when you have arrived at a figure, we must know what is included in that figure. And that will be easy for us. Because a figure just that is thrown there, we don't know, we can't do anything about it. It's just a figure that is there. So, as you talk, you must convince us, you must motivate for what you are saying, so that we understand the background that you are coming from. You are not forced to put a figure if you don't have a figure, but you must then motivate and tell us what is that you think should happen, or which things that must be taken into consideration as that decision is being decided. Any more questions of clarity? I'm thinking of the trade union. There are two trade unions in my head.
NUMSA.
NUMSA. You know, it's none of the above that I had in my head. So, NUMSA, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one or two comments I want to make about the presentation that we just had. I agree. I think it's not keeping with the theme of the workshop. I think the theme of the workshop very clearly, this is a workshop on the national minimum wage. But without dismissing the content of that presentation, I think, and just by way of some advice, there's a bargaining council for the transport industry, and the figures on wages and the different categories of occupations are all there, and they can be accessed. To the extent in which the transport industry would overlap with other sectors like the tourism and so on, I think there must be some provision. Probably, I'm not from the transport industry, but I think that would be covered. I do want to make one comment, and I think this is that when evidence is being presented here, they could be presented in two forms. One is that the hard, readily available information that you can get from bargaining councils, from stats, essays, and so on. But I think the committee would also have to make some space and room for anecdotal evidence, which is something that we got from the earlier presentation from the representatives, you know, who spoke on behalf of domestic workers. Now, anecdotal evidence is not scientific, but it can also be very, very relevant. And sometimes we find that the anecdotal evidence corresponds in some ways very, very closely with what the scientific evidence or what the scientific indicators would be. So I think the committee must keep that in mind that, very substantive, variable evidence is required, but that there will be instances for anecdotal evidence, and that should be completely ignored. I'm not going to say too much because I think there are other presentations and we are presenting tomorrow. So we will sit and listen to other presentations and we will try and participate in this workshop as much as we can, and so that we can share our own experiences with the matter. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, members and members of the public. It's clear that there is no further engagement on the presentation that has been put in front of us. Now we have a third presentation
by Mr. C. Van der Rede, representing African Handel Institute. Over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just see my presentation looks a bit different from... can I just get the image and just click on nothing here quickly? Maybe I should argue about it. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this presentation. I titled it Creating and Sustaining an Environment Conducive for Business Growth, Human Development and High Wages. I just want to put on record, it's not the Afrikaans Honest Institute, it's AHI Business Network. Very importantly, I'm not going to speak at length to this. All of us are aware of the fact that economic resources are the goods or services available to individuals and businesses used to produce valuable consumer products. Then there are the four factors of production, land, labor, and capital. Very importantly, entrepreneurship is also considered an economic resource because individuals or companies are responsible for creating business and moving economic resources in the business environment. These economic resources are also called the factors of production. And then the practice of production describes the function that each resource performs in the business environment. I'm not going to be long on this. You know that land is an economic resource, and all the other resources that is found on the earth, and we translate that into products, and with that comes a whole range of services. Labor also represents the human capital available to transform these raw or natural resources into consumer goods. Capital, as two economic definitions, as a factor of production, can represent the monetary resources companies use to purchase natural resources, and very importantly, it also represents the major physical assets individuals and companies use when producing goods or services. Entrepreneurship is very close to my heart and my organization's heart because we are basically made up of entrepreneurs. Very importantly, entrepreneurship is considered a factor of production because economic resources can exist in an economy and not be transformed into consumer goods. Entrepreneurs usually have an idea for creating a valuable good or service and assume the risk involved with transforming economic resources into consumer goods. Who is the heartbeat of production? From our perspective, the entrepreneur is the heartbeat of production. Why do we say that? Without the entrepreneur willing to risk capital, innovatively transforming economic resources into consumer goods, employing labor, there can be no production. Government relies on the entrepreneur to create business and employment. And why do we say that? Contribution to GDP by private entrepreneurs in South Africa amounts to 83%. Contribution to GDP by the state amounts to 70%. Job creation by private entrepreneurs amounts to 72%. Job creation by the state amounts to 18%. We also see that the 2014 Global Risk Report by World Economic Forum states that in South Africa has the highest unemployment rate in the world for people between the ages of 15 and 24. So this is how it was stated that the unemployment rate amongst the same group and increased from 52.7% in 2008 to 56.1%. in 2014. What did government do? It responded by providing youth subsidies to private sector, amounting to almost 2 billion rand to employ young people. High youth unemployment has a negative impact on economic growth and productivity. It leads to reduced GDP and increase with the economic cost due to increased reliance on social grants. What does the National Development Plan say about the crucial role of the entrepreneur? It says the following: small and medium-sized enterprises will play an important role in employment creation. According to the first scope in 2006 survey, 90% of jobs, oh sorry, there's a bit of a mix-up. Let me repeat. Small and medium-sized enterprises will play an important role in employment creation according to the Finnish Scope survey. And very importantly, the National Development Plan says that 90% of jobs created between 1998 and 2005 were in small, medium, and micro enterprises. Despite this, total early stage entrepreneurial activity rates in South Africa are about half of what they are in other developing countries. Then a growing economy, rising employment and incomes, falling inequality, and improving education system creates a fertile condition for entrepreneurship, and career mobility will contribute significantly to unite South Africa's people and also to lift people out of poverty. And importantly, the National Development Plan says also programs such as affirmative action, black economic empowerment, and land reform are most effective when the economy is growing and the education system is improving. Without such an environment, these measures can raise the level of social tension. It's important that all of us have a common understanding of the need for more entrepreneurial entities in South Africa and a common appreciation of how it works. Very importantly, entrepreneurial entities are made up of many administrative and management functions, products, services, groups, and individuals. Various inputs informed by elements like the vision and vision, and you'll see how I've structured it, and I'll show a diagram later on. And I compare that with another system, values, the human sensor system, employers and employers, hands and fingers, direct and indirect cost, respiratory system, products, services, cardiovascular system, administration, muscular system, resources, digestive system, marketing, skeletal system, safety and security, lymphatic system, networking, reproductive system, and monitoring, evaluation, legs and feet. All of these are processes to produce certain outputs which will better accomplish the overall desired goal for a business entity. How does this entity look like and how does it operate? There it is. Enterprise, vision and mission, that I've already said, I've compared that with the NERS system. The values that undersaw that enterprise is a lymphatic system, because that system in your body fights off all the diseases and the germs. Very importantly, I compare the direct and indirect costs to the respiratory system. And on each side, you'll see the enterprise employees can either be right hand or left hand, the enterprise allocation and employee development, and on the other hand, the employer, his or her task allocation, and also very importantly, their development. And those two hands are very important. They need to work together. If the right hand and the left hand doesn't know what they are doing, that body is going to suffer at the end of the day. That body will not be able to sustain itself and to feed itself. And there you see the other parts of the body, which I have compared with the different body systems. Very importantly, any enterprise that functions optimally makes sure that all of those systems work in harmony, works together. The very, very important element of or system that forms part of that whole is the direct and indirect cost that has a major impact on the optimization and optimal function of any enterprise in South Africa. You see how electricity costs, other administrative costs, legal compliance, also our ability to compete with overseas products and services, how that impact on cost. And at the end of the day, cost has a major impact on all of those systems. And it can you can suffocate that body, and eventually it collapses. And we don't want that. We want fit businesses. And if we have fit businesses in South Africa that respond to the environment there, then obviously both employers and employees will be beneficiaries of a fit body. But what we find now, and all the figures have showed it, that most of the enterprises, most of our entrepreneurial entities are suffering as a result of costs. I said that the previous diagram outlines the operational elements of a complex system such as entrepreneurial enterprise. Entrepreneurial enterprises operate as an organized whole. All the elements that make up this whole are all intimately connected. For entrepreneurial enterprises to operate effectively and efficiently, it is important that a holistic and integrated governance and management approach is followed. According to systems theory, a system is an organized collection of parts that are highly integrated to accomplish an overall goal. A highly functioning system, like an entrepreneur's entity or business, continually exchanges feedback amongst its various parts to ensure that they remain closely aligned and focused on achieving particular outcomes such as profitability, sustainability, competitiveness, expansion, and progress realization of employee development and job security. Any of the parts or activities of an business entity seems weakened or misaligned, the entity makes necessary adjustments to more effectively achieve its goals. Creating conditions, circumstances for the entrepreneur and for that body to function optimally is crucial. The National Development Plan proposes a multidimensional framework to bring about a virtuous cycle of development, with progress in one area supporting advances in others. How will this work in practice? South Africa's principal challenge is to roll back poverty and inequality. Raising living standards to the minimum level proposed in the plan will involve a combination of increasing employment, high income through productivity growth, a social wage, and good quality public services. All of these challenges are interlinked. Improved education, for example, will lead to higher employment and earnings, while more rapid economic growth will broaden opportunities for all and generate the resources required to improve education. I've also developed another diagram that will indicate to you how important or how can we bring about a vibrant and growing rural economy and urban economy. Of course, it just do not just happen. It is the end result of various strategic interventions and cultivation of specific fundamentals such as economic organization, cooperation, innovation, networking, empowerment, rule of law, entrenching and expanding private ownership, service delivery, competitiveness, and sustainability and commitment to specific ground rules and values that bring about growth and development. These ground rules and values are aligned in various progressive constitutional, institutional, and legislative frameworks, such as the National Constitution, the Millennium Development Goals, and the National Development Plan. There is the circle of economic growth. And you see, it starts right in the middle. And first and foremost, it starts with economic organization. We need to entrench a culture of economic organization. Wherever I go in this country, I found a massive emphasis on political organization. Given our background, it's understandable. But we haven't shifted to a level where we organize our communities economically. There's different strategies that one can follow. But out of economic organization, we want to see economic cooperation as opposed to economic conflict. Out of that cooperation between your municipalities, the different business stakeholders, community stakeholders, labor, we want to see greater innovation, economic innovation, as opposed to bureaucratic. Out of that, we want to see how can we keep the land within the rhythm, without people just earning their salaries outside of the township, coming back, moving back, and out of moving back to Saturday morning to San Francisco Spencer Day. We need to create and understand the principle of economic networking as opposed to isolation. Our organization plays a crucial role in terms of economic empowerment. What do we mean by that as opposed to disempowerment? The rule of law, entrenching and enhancing that, because you cannot have sustainable economic activities in an environment where the rule of law does not apply as opposed to lawlessness. Entrenching private ownership, so that can serve as collateral for people to develop themselves as opposed to economic dependency. In economic sustainability, many of our dysfunctional municipalities are hampering that economic empowerment because we do not succeed in creating conducive circumstances for economic, sustainable economic activities. And very importantly, economic competitiveness as opposed to uncompetitiveness. And then sustainability. We find that many of our young people start the business 3 months, 4 months down the line, they are the business. They're not sustainable. What is the ideal? As business, we want to see growth. We want to see an environment which is conducive for local economic development as opposed to decay. All of this in red eventually leads to this. All of the green, yes, that's not the panacea for our economic woes, but we believe if we have these building blocks in place, the ones in green, we will get to a point where we have sustainable economic growth. National development also plan also talks about a multidimensional framework to bring about a virtuous cycle of development. Countries are caught up in a virtuous cycle of development where human development and economic growth goes hand in hand, or a vicious cycle of human underdevelopment which goes hand in hand with economic stagnation and even decay. From a development perspective, the desirable category to be in is, of course, the virtuous cycle of development. The virtuous cycle of development drives human development and economic growth sustainable. You cannot have either or. It is an and approach that we should follow. Given appropriate economic policies, improved human development allows a transition into a virtuous cycle. China is a perfect example of a country that moved from a vicious cycle position to a sustained virtuous cycle. And that is brought about through economic reforms and accelerated growth. And then, very importantly, high levels of human development support. Nigeria, on the other hand, you see they experience a vicious cycle. And they are caught up in that. So Africa must be careful that we do not find ourselves in a position where we are in the midst of a vicious cycle. To get out of that is a tricky business. Our point of view is that the minimum wage serves as an important human development and economic growth imperative. We must, however, guard against a one-shoe-fits-all approach in the South African context, given the already high unemployment rate and the low levels of anticipated economic growth. Statistics South Africa, in its latest Modern Labour Survey, states that out of a working age population, 5.8 million people, 15.5 million people are unemployed, 5.5 million are unemployed, and 14.8 million are not economically active, thus resulting in an unemployment rate of 26.4%. The HI is of the opinion that wages should indeed be regulated in a context such as that in South Africa, but the level at which minimum wage is set should take into account the likely negative effects on employment. That's the bigger challenge that we face. Should we focus on getting more people into jobs, or should we focus on entrenching a national minimum wage? HI is also of the opinion that such regulation should focus on sectoral minimum wages. What the level should be a matter of sectoral research and bargaining. Minimum wages present one of the most difficult choices to any policy maker, especially us in South Africa, where we are faced with high poverty, inequality, and unemployment. I thank you for this opportunity to present this. Thank you.
Thank
Thank you very much, and apologies for the name of your organization. Members of Parliament and that of the public, if there are clarities that you want to get from the presentation, allowed to do so. I can't hear Honourable Buckling. Can you speak through the mic?
I apologize, Madam Chair. We don't have a copy of the presentation, but I see that the presenter has got it on a disc or a toggle for us, so maybe we could get that. If he could send that to our content advisor, and then at least we can then explore that in more detail. I don't actually have a comment per se. Thank you.
Okay. We agree with that. The secretary of the committee will be in touch with you so that we can have copies. Honourable Lewis, you wanted to say something?
Yes, Chairperson, just my apologies again for being late. I left from the airport on a late flight. Behind me is a student. She is studying in her final years at school, and her name is Rebecca. I just want to welcome her. She's come just to check what is it that we do here in Parliament. So I hope nobody minds. She's just sitting in, and she asked if she could take a photo to show the people at school this meeting room, so it's not to embarrass anybody, but we have asked permission first. So I'm just asking if she could take a photo on her iPad to show at school. And then the other thing is, I agree if we could please get that presentation. And I missed the start. Could you just tell us the name of the organization? Who do you represent? Thanks, Jim.
The HI Business Network.
Honorable Ollis, the presentation will be sent to us. So I'm sure that presentation will get the full details of which organization are they coming from. Rebecca, you are welcome in this committee of portfolio on labor, portfolio committee on labor. So if you wish to take photos, you are welcome to do so. Any questions of clarity? There's a hand at the back, that left that there at the back, and then there's another hand there. That's two hands there. So in that order, we start with gentlemen there who's going to introduce himself, and the other one, and the, so just introduce yourself and the organization that you're coming from.
Okay.
You can talk.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm Toilet January, Chairperson Small Business Development Portfolio, Kitchen of Commerce and Industry. I appreciate the presentation that's been made by AHI Business Network. Mine is not a question, but a contribution. Our government has actually developed a program of action known as the MDP 2030. With the vision of creating massive job opportunities. I think, adding on what the presentations have said, we will definitely need to look at a model. That is to say, because of the fact that the small business sector has been a major job contributor, up to 52% of the GDP, and if now we actually just look on one side of the coin and say this is the minimum wage, without taking into consideration what are the key challenges facing various sectors in terms of business, would end up not meeting our main vision, which is about job creation leading to economic development. If, for example, I could just share, if you look in terms of the services sector, and then begin to say this is a minimum wage, There are no entrance in that sector. There are existing entrance. How do you ensure that those your entrance are accommodated? Because at the end of the day, one would end up saying, rather than, because I'm just new in business, there's no access to finance, etc., rather than employing someone, let me work alone. In that way, we end up not meeting our main vision. So my recommendation, Chairperson, is for us to thoroughly relook at this process of saying, how do we ensure a minimum wage? And has that been vetting? Do we vet, or we just say this is a minimum wage, irrespective of whether you are Greyhound or just someone that does establish a transportation business? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tobeli Chenyari. Yes, the only thing that your organization have done to us is to deprive us of a presentation that will assist however we take what you are saying. But I know that you are among those organizations that are not going to be doing a presentation to the committee. If you change your mind and you have something that is written, we also welcome written submissions. Thank you. There was another hand.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, Labour Portfolio Committee, and also your fellow honourable members, and also the delegates from the public. My name is Mtekisi Kambolekwa, the Secretary for BOPRU, Police and Prison Civil Rights Union in the Western Cape, as well as the COSATU Provincial Executive Committee member. Thanks for the presentation from the presenter. Just want to check, what is your position? Certainly, maybe I didn't get you very well. I didn't catch up. What is your position on this minimum wage? Thank you.
To whom that question is directed?
To the presenter. The presenter itself. Oh. What is the position of the organization on the minimum wage? Well, I want to get a clarity whether I captured correctly. Seemingly to me, you don't have a position. They are opposed to a minimum wage. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Do you prefer to answer one by one? Because there's another. Just let's take the second one. Okay. Maybe they might be interdependent. The gentleman next to you, please.
Thanks, Chairperson. My name is Abram Daniels. I'm from Food and Allied Works Union, FAO, Provincial Equator. Thanks for the presentations also, in especially the one from Setsawu, give us a bit more deep analysis in terms of the expenses that the mesa workers do have in their daily life, and give us some grace to where we can work with looking at the minimum wage. The last presentation of AHI, somehow spoke to human resource development and economic sustainability. I think in this house, and the reason for government going through for the minimum wage was not just found out of the air in terms of we want to create minimum wage. I think government's approach through the NDP is to create sustainable jobs and create economic growth as far as possible. But the minimum wage is an avenue which is well, I suppose also to be well within our sectors, and it's not there yet. So we believe that the presentation didn't make mention of any figures. It speaks about a job creation, human development, which all agree should happen as we progress in our society. But what is the core? How does AHI see this minimum wage implemented? Because we got the sectors, we understand that. We need to have some level of payment that needs to come into play so that we can have discussions or decisions around that. And yourself, the same person can make back and say, this is the level that we can work with, and there's nothing at this fiscal year on ASI. And we want to know, are they in support of it, of a minimum wage, and what levels do they also think should be the level of where we should pitch the going rate for a minimum wage. Thank you.
Thank you.
Daniel. Let me allow the gentleman to answer two questions. Because you wanted to answer that one, so before there are too many, let me give him that opportunity. Then I've noted your hand, madam. Over to you, sir.
Thank you for the two questions. And I just highlighted the following on my presentation. We are of the opinion that the minimum wage is a human development and economic growth imperative. Why do we say that? We sit with an apartheid legacy where people, and especially workers, were pushed into townships that acted as labor units. Those townships are far away from work. I live down in Pretoria and I see how people must take a bus at 4 o'clock in the morning, driving from places like Amanskraal and those places, coming to work. And there's no way that you can allow a situation where employers pay them whatever they want them to pay. Because we need to overcome that structural legacy that was left by apartheid. We agree with that. Secondly, very importantly, we must however guard against a one-shoe-fits-all approach in the South African context, given the already high unemployment rate and the low levels of anticipated economic growth. We are, in essence, not supporting a blanket national minimum wage. We believe in a sectoral approach, and together with that, we want to see proper research. We want to see that government, together with business, make sure that we assist workers in terms of especially their living conditions. Because it is only via a strong partnership with business, together with municipalities, together with the different state departments, ensure that workers' living conditions are properly addressed. That is a big legacy of the apartheid state, which we cannot ignore. But on the other hand, we see massive unemployment at this point in the townships. And we need to balance the two. On the one hand, we need to get people into employment, but on the other hand, we must make sure that we sustain businesses. Because businesses are now confronted with massive increases in administrative costs, in activity costs, and all kinds of other compliance costs. And there are other factors that impact on sustainability and profitability of business. I don't have answers for that, unfortunately. I haven't done that research. I haven't done that research. That is something that we are part of PISA, and we will, together with PISA, make sure that we do much deeper research with regard to them. And I don't think it's just our prerogative. We need to take hands with government, we need to take hands with people and sit around the table and say, but how can we address this? What are the figures that we can look at? But we must be very careful that we have a blanket approach. We believe that we must have sectoral bargaining and research as a starting point, and we must make sure that we, on the one hand, get people into jobs, but also address the factors that undermine human development and economic growth. That's a difficult thing. Thank you.
Thank you for your explanation. There was a hand that was up there. Thank you, Chairperson. I'm not trying to turn this into being a dialogue, but can I pose my question to Mr. January? I just wanted to ask, when he was posing his question, I mean, when he was making his comment, I understand that he was trying to make emphasis on this point of the blanket minimum wage, whereby he was just saying that we must take into account the National Development Plan, the Vision 2030. I just wanted to ask, when he's talking about small businesses, do they also consider the effect that the incentives that these small businesses to get from the government? If we are saying that we are not going to make this minimum wage a blanket
a blanket national minimum wage? Are we not ignoring the incentives that government does give to the small businesses as well? Thank you. Thank you. I'll take a second question before I give an opportunity to Mr. Senyori to respond. Madam?
Morning, my name is Michael Redway and I'm from the Domestic Workers Union. I think, you know, the paper that I presented, it's very educational. It opens our eyes to many things. We know all that is happening in South Africa, and also know the different departments that must address some of these issues in the presentation. But my question would be, at the moment, there's so many discussions going about a national wage. There's all the discussion going about a minimum living wage. The discussion going about a minimum decent wage. My question would be to my, what you say in South Africa, comrade, if I my question is, you also show us the negative side of saying that if there is a minimum wage, often it results in unemployment. Yet so many times, as soon as the minimum wage is raised, the newspaper broadcasts the workers will lose their jobs, but often times it's not so, especially in the domestic sector, if we have more than a million domestic workers employed. The question would be, if you then propose that no, maybe a national minimum wage won't work, do you then think that a minimum living wage or a better minimum wage will work? Because most of it is very negative what you are saying there, that both rates will create unemployment. So I would just like some possible positive response from you in which way you see this would work. Thank you.
Okay. Generally, do you want to respond to the question?
Okay, thank you very much. I think with what I was saying earlier, I concur with my colleague at HR that definitely there should be a thoroughly researched sectoral approach, because if we just look only on one side to say this is what we want, and not taking into consideration the slow growth of our economy, we are then going to face quite a lot of unemployment. With regards to the incentives by our government, if that is happening, but it's not happening at a pace that would create a job acceleration. So what I'm saying in a nutshell is, definitely there should be a thorough approach to say how do we ensure that at the end of the day both parties are committed to the marriage. Thank you very much.
That was the response. Is there any follow-up question? Do you want to answer? You are satisfied, okay? Let's give Mr. Van der Vierde an opportunity to respond to the questions. And if there are studies or research that you have done to the extent of where the workers have lost jobs, or practical examples. I think these questions that are coming out will assist with the...
Thank you. There is one study that was done in the United States amongst restaurants in, I think, New York, I'm speaking out of pressure, that I think the outcome of that study was that there is no link between a minimum wage and job losses. But then studies were also done in other countries, mostly developing countries, that proved there is a link between minimum wage or national minimum wage and job losses. Now, very importantly,
all of these things depend on context. In our case, what we are saying is that in South Africa we are currently confronted with those issues: poverty, inequality and unemployment. We do not want to exacerbate them via wrong policy choices. Because if we do not address those three issues, then we're going to have serious, serious social upheaval in this country. There are two ways of addressing poverty, inequality and unemployment. That is to make sure there's a vibrant private sector that creates jobs, and there are incentives to encourage them to want to invest in South Africa, to want to invest in the businesses, and to employ people. And I think the step of government to introduce the youth wage subsidy was a step in the right direction. We need to inform people for that. On the other hand, to address poverty, inequality and employment, you need a strong state. I am dead set against unbridled capitalism, where we have those at the top becoming richer and richer and those at the bottom poorer and poorer. I believe in a complete different approach where we have a strong state, a strong private sector working hand in hand to grow our industries and make sure that via the state we deliver top quality service, top quality education, top quality local government services and the various state department services. If we can get that right in South Africa, we will be able to address poverty, inequality and unemployment and the issue of a minimum wage. Currently, we are in a very, very fragile economic state. And that fragile economic state, on the one hand, is due to less and less investment. On the other hand, poor service delivery by not all municipalities, by certain municipalities and by state departments. We need to address that. To get to a point where we say these are the factors that is causing that fragile state of low private sector investment and businesses closing down on their own and also poor service delivery. And once we address those factors, I believe economic growth, human development, all of those things will lead to a position where we look each other into the eye and say, but we need to address the issue of a minimum wage and even a national minimum wage. But if there's no money, I'm a business person, I need to sit and worry about keeping my restaurant or my business open. Because the electricity bill has gone up from 20,000 rand a month to 60,000 rand a month. If I need to worry about a possible increase in the interest rate, and I will have now higher servicing cost of my debt, the last thing that I am going to worry about is to employ more people. So, I think sometimes we are a bit lopsided when it comes to these type of issues. I am a great believer in great partnerships. Through our chambers, we do a lot of development work of young entrepreneurs. We engage with municipalities. We make our expertise within those chambers available, especially our chartered accountants, so that they can assist municipalities to get the finances right. We make our engineers available to assist with making sure that there's clean water, there's proper sanitation in that town, etc. We make sure that we work together with municipalities to create a conducive environment for investment, for business growth, for employment. And perhaps that should be a starting point, to create viable partnerships. But you know, how often have I knocked on the door of the small business department to say, here we are. We want to assist, we do have expertise, and we are blunt equals.
You know, I often get knocked on municipalities' doors, say, here we are, we want to help, we are just flagging. Just coming back to what I'm supposed to say is that for us, slave wages is up. For us, abusing workers, mistreating workers is up. Central to business or our business organization is addressing the legacies of apartheid, making sure that we align whatever we do with the values and ideals contained in our national constitution. And I've done an analysis yesterday where I'm advising now some of my affiliates to draw up a social accord, so that through a social accord we start dealing with those three issues on a proper basis. But very importantly, we must not take these issues, or we must not take decisions hastily when it comes to this. We need to prioritize and ask ourselves what are the priorities at this point in time. How are we going to deal with poverty, inequality, and unemployment? And I think unemployment is our biggest challenge at this point in time. And I think the foremost question should be, how do we create more jobs? How do we make sure people get more money into their pockets? How do we develop our schooling system so that people have the necessary skills to deal with the new economy out there? Because that's one of the other problems. Many of our people do not have the skills and the education background to deal with the new economy that is confronting society at this point in time. And very importantly, how do we deal strategically with taking care of our industries? We have signed agreements with international counterparts, but at this point in time, we are losing out. Our textile factories closed down. Our mining sector is under severe pressure because some of our counterparts have imported raw materials to the extent where they now building the smelters in their own countries. And once they build those smelters, what will happen? They will be able to produce the stainless steel and the steel products at a much lower cost than we are producing in South Africa. And that will lead to even more unemployment. No business person that I've spoken about, and who are members of my organization, have a sort of non-caring attitude towards workers. They care about their workers deeply. They go out of their way. They even pay much more than the minimum wage. They make sure they are not intense for their workers, because they know workers are an essential component of that body. If the workers are sick, the body is sick, as I've shown you earlier. But we must be very careful that we do not come up with policies that at the end of the day undermine the spirit of entrepreneurship in this country. Because what will happen? We will chase more people into the informal sector. And the informal sector, there, everything goes. The formal sector faces the brunt of policy decisions that are not always business friendly. And at the end of the day, if it's not business friendly, that entrepreneur will be solely responsible for turning the other three factors of production into something that can result into any economic activity. That person says, well, I just leave South Africa, I go to another country, and they shut their businesses. Yes, we need to focus on the living conditions. And from our side, we are committed to make sure that we create, together with state entities, better economic conditions for our workers and social conditions for our workers. But we mustn't force down a blanket national wage that at the end of the day destroy that spirit of entrepreneurship that exists and at this point is very fragile. Thank you very much.
Gentleman from the room.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a bit worried that we seem to be talking about two different things here. That we're talking about a national minimum wage, and at the same time, there's been a number of references to sectoral determinations. Now, Mr. Van der Veer has pointed out, and he says the starting point should be sectoral determinations, or we should look at the different sectors. Now, sectoral determinations have been here for some time. They've been here for the last couple of years, in fact, slightly less than a decade. And they vary across different sectors. But the distinction between national minimum wage and what we call a sectoral determination, they're not one and the same thing. Now, it's very difficult to speak of a national minimum wage and then at the same time say you want some form of downward variation. I can't see that happening, and I can't see how that is going to work. I think there are certain principal issues, and we have to make certain principal choices. We can look at the international examples of a national minimum wage, and then we must come to some sort of agreement. Do we want a national minimum wage, or are we sticking to the old form of sectoral determinations? But we must be clear that they are not one and same thing. They are different, there is a huge distinction between them. So I think we want to enhance the debate. And perhaps that might happen when we get presentations from the other labor federations that are here, including our South Azusa. Perhaps then we might be able to open it up in a more wider context. I think it's a bit, and I don't want to preempt the outcomes of these debates, and I think the debates have been great ones since last year. It was the latter part of last year, and they've all been provisionaries. So it can, to some point, I agree, be a bit emotive, but I think it's a very serious issue. It's an issue that goes back, there's a historical context to the debate about national minimum wage, not just here in Africa, but elsewhere in the world. There are various international examples. So if we want to couple that with other forms of economic development and economic growth, then I think I agree with that. I think we must link it with that. But we mustn't lose sight of the fact that there are currently existing several sectoral determinations, and the manner in which these sectoral determinations have been implemented and the extent to which they've been monitored is something that has been researched, has shown to be a bit problematic. Clearly the issue of compliance, when the academic institutions were presenting theirs, some of them pointed out that the issue of compliance has become a problem. So we have to take into account all these factors. We can't just isolate the one from the other. So even with the existing sectoral determinations, the question of evaluating them, and the issue of monitoring them, and compliance and so on, all these things will have to be taken into account. But again, keep in mind that a national minimum wage is as distinct from sectoral determination as anything else. Thank you.
Any more? If we have called the members of public, and we did not just call anybody, we were selective in calling you. We called you because we believe that you will be in a position to assist us to take the right position. You should not come in front of us and be general. You are from different companies. And I think it's fine if you want to be general. You can be general, but it will not assist much in taking into account your own conditions, meaning your own factories, your own companies, or your own trade unions, or your own specific financial and economic conditions where you come from. When you are too general, when you just look at the general researches that really are not going to be assistive in your own situation. We call you because we want you to cite examples of your own situation and say, in my situation, I've got workers, but my financial, without you declaring and put here what is in your book, it will not assist me. As you are going to be taking this position, please take these into account. For instance, in my own company,
I've got 10 workers, or I've got 10 workers who are not coming on daily basis. And this is what I earn, not necessarily giving us details, but we have selected you so that we know your own situation. And as we deal with this matter, we take your situation into consideration. But once you come here and show us your own, what is in the media, that this is going to lead to this, and not substantiate on that, just talk general research, you are not really going to the answer. So I appeal to you, as you speak, don't go far from your own situation, because you are here for your own situation. Though we are talking national, we must talk national and take into account all these situations that you would have narrated in front of us. So it must be a combination of the two. You want to go globally too, but you will also, while doing that, you're also going globally, but at the end, whatever we get outside there and what we get from you, we will have to look at all these things that you want us to look at. The economic situation of South Africa and all the other things. We're not going to be dogmatically when we apply this minimum wage. Number of things. That's why it was something that was decided and say, oh, tomorrow the minister or the president just announced. The minister, the president has given the deputy president a responsibility to check, to investigate. In fact, the words that he used were quoting verbatim, to investigate, meaning that all these other situations that you are telling us about are situations that all of us, that we are taking into consideration. But get closer home, because you don't want to be more disadvantaged by the situation, and only to find that when you were given an opportunity to talk, you just came here and then general and not talk about your condition. Small business, we know the situation. But if they don't talk to us, we know all of them, we know how they operate, we know their difficulties. You know, they are good things about them, that are more good than what is being done by the big businesses. But I'm going to speak for them. We will, they must speak, of course, we are not saying that when we take that decision is taken into consideration, we will use the information what we have. If there is nothing more from their side, maybe there might be things that we don't know. That is the situation to come and talk to us and say, for us, yes, we can't say no, but you must know this is how we earn our own money. I am a small business, but there are times when, you know, I get tender of so much and I've got so much. There are a number of things that must share with us. Please come closer to your own situation. You can talk about South Africa, you can talk about other countries, but after that, come back to you, to your trade, to you, to whoever, whatever sectors that you are representing here. Then we'll understand more. Mr. January?
Thank you, Sir President. My last comment, just to indicate, I've been working with the small businesses since 2001. And also did a research through the city of Cape Town in the arts and crafts sector. And also being fully active at the Cape Regional Chamber of Commerce and Industry, working with small business owners. In my election in the last 11 years, I've elected with quite a lot on those who employ between 2 and 10 employees.
And out of the interaction, I would confidently tell this house that most of them do, even though they are very, very passionate on business, they've got, they face quite a lot of challenges in terms of barriers to entry on business development, but have been keen on keeping their employees on board. But if you look in terms of the financial indicators, you could hardly see that there's quite a lot more who actually are below the threshold of 200,000 rand, you know, even the annual, you know. So, in a nutshell, I think we definitely need our government to relook at the process. In this instance, I'm not only talking about those small business owners who are from the African background. I'm talking just in the general context, you know, because we are interacting across the colors, you know. So I think there is a guarantee for all the parties to come to the party and relook at the issue of the national minimum wage. Thank you very much.
Any more questions, madam, please? Thank you. Good morning. I'm Harmon Simpson. I'm the Deputy Chair of Human Resources for the Cape Chamber of Commerce, and I'm also a business owner in Human Resources Consulting and Psychometric Assessments. Thank you for the comments made. I really enjoyed listening to some and gave me also a different perspective on my own experiences that I've had. I'd also like to add, in terms of the internship programs, very specifically, if I look at what the age practitioners, for example, would get, 1,500 through a CETA, but if I take another CETA, they pay 3,000, but these people don't even have anything beyond the matric. So there's already a discrepancy even with amongst the CETA. And these are one of the things that I try to do when I present to my clients to help them to run HR not only as a cost center, but also to see that HR can be an income generator, which is what I just use to distinguish myself from other HR practitioners. And in so doing, ensuring and assisting them to be compliant, and at the end also be able to experience or receive the government in its tax rebates and incentives. So what I try to assist with and assisting, given that the discrepancies are one, the same team that I work with within was one retail and the other HR. So the one see what the other earns. And I just think that we need to be very cautious from the grassroots level, because that's where our young people enter the job market. What message are we sending? And we should be very careful to send the message of mediocrity is being rewarded twice the value of an income or stipend to that of a graduate or postgraduate. The 3,000 to a matriculant versus 1,500 to a graduate and postgraduate. So those are the concerns that I see. In terms of, that's the one point I would like to make, another point if I may, still regarding the national minimum wage. I see that we also clearly have a huge problem in our country with a high unemployment and with a very low GDP. And from an actual perspective, what I've done in the company that I've worked in prior to going on my own was to suggest a basic minimum salary, which I've fought over the years, and we managed to increase it to X amount. So let's use, for example, a figure of 3,000 rand. So that becomes the minimum, for example, wage. And then create incentive-based incomes where employees are then encouraged, in addition to incentives, which is monthly, if they have the targets. So if they exceed that, they can actually earn additional money. By doing that, one, two, also performance-based performance bonuses, and not because I'm here 10, 20 years, but I'm dead and I'm not adding value. In doing that, we're creating a culture of high performance and not mediocrity, and we're actually, in doing so, actually clearly indicated that companies are increasing productivity. By increasing productivity nationally, the profit levels went up, and therefore we were able to give people the incentives, and also included in that eventually was the employee profit sharing as well, which we gave dividends twice a year. So employees could now have salary adjustments twice a year, performance bonus once a year, annual increase, and twice a year dividends. In doing that, we're actually creating a culture as an indicator. And then in addition to that, of course, is to put systems in place from an HR perspective of multi-skilling and upskilling, as it is from the AHR correctly mentioned. Because without that, we are going to give, and that's why I link that directly to the internship program and the learnership program. And we really need to look at those things, because if it's not started with coffee, these young people enter the world of work with a wrong perception of entitlement, and shouldn't be that. Because those are very mindsets that negatively affect our economy. Thank you.
Thank you so much. If there are no other hands, We have Ms. R. Kavenda. Are you Ms. Kavenda? Do you want to say something? Okay, before you, Ms. Kavenda. Yeah, I love you.
Good day, I'm from the fishing industry, and I'm very specifically from the Large Pelagic SMME Association, which is small-based business fishing industry. I'd just like to make a few comments about labour in the small sector, that's in small business and fishing, very specifically, very different from the large fishing businesses that we are more familiar with, INJs and TRs of this world, which are primarily based on large quotas and quota driven through the year. The bulk of these small businesses, the SMEs in the fishing industry, are single boats or very small sort of companies employing anything from 5 to 20 people, and they are all SMEs, tiny businesses trying to survive. I think it's not a secret that the SMEs are the lifeblood of any third world emerging market, emerging economy, and I don't know how many of you run SMEs in South Africa. I've heard a few comments this morning already, but the SMEs, running an SME in South Africa is not an easy task. It is administration, bureaucracy that could drive you to drink, let alone still have to deal with excessive labour issues. In these very small sectors, small fishing sectors, the specific difference on our specific small sector being the Large Pelagic SME Association is it's an effort-based fishery. I'm not sure how many of you are aware of the difference, but an effort-based fishery means that it is controlled by the amount of effort that goes to sea, that is generally the number of boats and the number of people that go to sea, as opposed to a quota-based fishery, which is driven by giving a company a specific amount of quota catch. If you have an amount of quota catch for a year, it is a lot easier to present a budget and have some kind of formal structure in place where you can budget for operational expenses, including length of the year. In an effort-based fishery, you rely on the fact that when the fish does come near your shores, and we deal with the fish that swim past our shores, many of which go past our shores to other international areas through the course of the year, we only have the chance to catch it with the amount of effort, the amount of boats we put onto it at any given time, and when that's gone, it's gone. Impossible to plan. It's based on weather patterns, sea temperature patterns, currents, all different conditions that depend on how much of the fish can catch. So it's possible to budget and plan, and thereby budget some form of minimum wage, as you might want to put it. All these small fishing-based companies and boats on the effort-based fishery remunerate their crews in the form of some form of fixed daily rate, usually very low, and the bulk of the income is based on a catch performance. It is because you never know how many days you're going to get to go fishing for a year, you never know how much fish you're going to catch.
My sincere apologies. In fact, I've got an old child been listening as well. It's like, he said, are you doing a presentation about it? From the fishing industry? Are you doing a presentation?
No, I'm just making a comment.
Just a comment?
Yeah. Sorry, would you like a full presentation later?
No. If you're saying it's a comment, it's fine, but are you not reading, you are talking?
I'm talking.
Oh, okay. Another bloody word? Just a second, sir.
Then, my understanding is that whatever comment you are making is supposed to flow from the presentation you have done. But now when you listen to that comment, it's more on a particular trend, and it's more of a presentation not flowing from the presentation of AHR. That's what I wanted to suggest, that let the gentleman link his comment to the presentation made, so that he don't move from pillar to post.
That's a humble suggestion. So if you want to make a presentation, are they in the list of the presenters? Do they have written submissions? Nothing. Okay. You can give us your written submission. You can also be featured in those who would want to present. And indeed, the discussions here are flowing from what has been presented. However, if you want to say something on national minimum wage from what is presented, that is fine, or something that has been presented linking your own situation, and make it clear so that it doesn't, it's not too long and appear as, because you get lost in the process. So which way do you want to, you can finish and conclude, and then later on give us submission.
Very good, Madam Chair. So I was asked to be here. I was under the impression that the body had presented a written submission. If Madam Chair allows, I would like the opportunity to offer a written submission, maybe for even presentation tomorrow if necessary, and I can comment on that.
We'll look at the list of those that we have, but then look at the amount of the presentations, maybe you might fit in. Do you have your presentation with you today?
I don't have it here.
Or tomorrow. Oh, okay. Yeah, let's try and squeeze and see if we can push tomorrow. They'll come back to you. I'm sure we can do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sir?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bonfumi Oswald. I'm CEO of Agri Limpopo from Polokwane, in the north. I would like to think what I want to say to what AHI said, and also meant by the gentleman from NUMSA on the national minimum wage, as well as a sectoral determination. It's very important for us in the agriculture sector in the north of the country to really consider this question posed by the gentleman from NUMSA. Are we going to work on a national minimum wage there, or are we going to stick to a sectoral determination as it is at the moment? If I can just quickly refresh your minds, not long ago there was quite a huge hike in the sectoral determination for agriculture, around about 51% hike, and that shedded 73,000 jobs in agriculture. So what that shows us is there's a sensitivity in the agricultural sector for any raising of the sectoral determination. So from our side, we want to plea that we will please take into account the specifics, economic specifics, for the agricultural sector. The other thing that we are having quite big problems with in the northern or in Limpopo province, you know, we've got three neighboring countries. If you investigate their minimum wages in these countries, some of them are as low as a quarter of what the current minimum wage in agricultural sector is, which causes a lot of these people to run to South Africa for jobs. We already have too high unemployment in our own country. But these guys, they are just streaming into our country. Now, the pulling power is the higher sectoral determination, higher than it is in their countries at the moment. Our biggest problem actually is that the border control is not existing there anymore. There's no border fence, there's nothing. The corruption amongst our own officials is really running rampant. And that causes that we don't have a solution to this problem by raising our national minimum wage more or higher than what the sectoral determination in agriculture is at the moment, will in at least the Limpopo province cause havoc, taking into account what the situation there is on the borders. So I really want us to think a little bit more about the crucial sectors, and I think agriculture is a crucial sector. So if we have to step down from sectoral determination to a national minimum wage, and the national minimum wage is going to be linked to other sectors and say they can afford much more, then what the gentleman from NUMSA said here is really very, very much important. So I think from the beginning, from the outset today, we must keep that in mind. We must make, as he suggested, we must make a decision. Are we going with the minimum wage way, or are we going to stick to our sectoral determination? Because whatever we are going to do, there is going to be consequences, and there is going to be a lot of non-intentional consequences, and we must think about that rather. Thank you.
I was waiting for Ms. Kavinda, because, but that's also a submission, even if it's not written from the agricultural sector. Let us finish with this presentation, and then after this presentation, after we have been added with it, we'll allow everybody or whoever wants to say something on the issue to talk. But let's then get to this presentation. Not that we have noted all these issues that have been raised by the CEO and then the deputy chairperson, all these people have spoken, including the chairman from the fishing industry. Let's go back to the program, Ms. Kavinda.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm sorry, I had to do what I had to do. On the side of the Confederation of South African Workers' Union, we appreciate this opportunity, and we would like to focus our presentation on specifically on the vulnerable sector, because we thought that would be the starting point to the debate that we have here today. The primary reason for work is to earn a living. However, what constitutes living is relative to a subjective being. Without doubt, millions of workers globally, although working, are growing poorer by the year, no less in our country. Research studies point to some alarming statistics in that as a country we are seeing growing levels of poverty. Almost half of 50% of the nation is living in abject poverty, where the national median wage, as indicated by Stats South Africa, is around 2,800 per month. Income differentials between the rich and the poor systemically shows an increasing tendency to escalate in favor of the rich. We witness the same divergence with regard to salary differentials between those with professional qualifications and those who are not certificated or with little certification. With that, we look at the long road to a minimum wage. The last century bears testimony to the fight for a minimum wage from the side of the trade union. However, what constitutes a minimum wage still bears investigation. Adding and sometimes compounding this debate is the notion as to what constitutes a living wage. According to Richard Anker, in their study at the ILO, when they did a study on the methodology around review in estimating living wage, this is what they said. An important reason why a living wage is not more widely applied is that that there is neither a generally accepted definition of what a living wage is, nor is there a generally agreed methodology on how to measure a living wage. Partly because of this, many companies do not attempt to pay their workers a living wage, and many governments do not seriously consider worker needs when they set minimum, set legal minimum wages. The above quotation, Madam Chair, sums up the challenges when consideration is given to the establishment of a minimum wage standard. However, whilst the concepts of a minimum wage and a living wage have been used synonymously and most times interchangeably, the question to ask is, what do these concepts really apply in context of the world work? To this end, we look at some international instruments that define these concepts as a way forward. And we look at two articles from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and that is Article 23b, I quote, "Everyone who works has a right to just and favorable remuneration, ensuring for himself and his family an existence worthy of human dignity and supplemented, if necessary, by other means of social protection." Article 25.1, I quote, reads as follows, "Everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services. The right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control." So internationally, we may call the soft law, but international standards have been set. And then we look at, in terms of the Minimum Wage Convention of 1970, number 131, the ILO defines minimum wage as the lowest level of remuneration permitted, which in each country has the force of law and which is enforceable under threat of penal or other appropriate sanction. Minimum wages fixed by collective agreement made binding by public authorities are included in this definition. Then we look at the last convention, the Minimum Wage Fixing Convention, and in terms of Article 3 of this convention, it reads, "The elements to be taken into consideration in determining the level of minimum wages shall, as far as possible and appropriate in relation to national factors and conditions, include the needs of workers and their families, taking into account the general level of wages in the country, the cost of living, social security benefits, and the relative living standards of other social groups. Economic factors, including requirements of economic development, levels of productivity, and the desirability of attaining and maintaining a high level of employment. In public policy, a living wage, in public policy, a living wage is the minimum income necessary for workers to meet their needs that are considered to be basic. These needs include shelter and other incidentals such as clothing and nutrition. Social Accountability International defines the living wage as the remuneration received for a standard work week by a worker in a particular place sufficient to afford a decent standard of living for the worker and her or his family. Elements of a decent standard of living include food, water, housing, education, health care, transport, clothing, and other essential needs, including provision for unexpected events. From the definitions as stated above, the following elements are derived that expand and contextualize the concepts within the world of work, which are the right to remuneration, which is internationally acknowledged as a fundamental human right and has been incorporated at domestic level in some form or another. For example, sector determination that the minimum no-go below standards. Some form of sanction may enforce a minimum wage that's within a country. At domestic level, sector determination do serve this purpose and naturally can be enforced. Every worker has a right to remuneration to ensure a decent standard of living for him and his family. Within the South African context, the Social Protection Net, which is state-sponsored, aims fundamentally to improve standards of living, and although meager, it does have the effect of reducing poverty. The context of the decent standard of living is further expanded in the following elements, which include housing, food, water, education, health care, transport, clothing, and other essential needs. But these will be discussed later. In South Africa, wages is subject to two things, regulation and or negotiation. Minimum rates of pay are regulated to the various sector determinations pertinent to the sector they serve, while sectors not under sector regulation may well negotiate their remuneration levels. Hence, specifically, we encounter inequalities between low and high wage earners, since high income earners are in more favorable position to negotiate their own wages as compared to the domestic worker working in a private household cut off from work solidarity. The vulnerable sectors, especially the farm and domestic workers, function largely outside the realm of formalized collective bargaining. The state being instrumental through a consultative process in setting minimum wages in these sectors. Such determination in these sectors regulate approximate to an average wage of approximately 2,000 rand per month. On the other hand, we experienced the power of bargaining with the Marikana strike, where workers themselves set a minimum standard of 12,000 per month through hardcore strike action. The same can be said upon workers in the Western Cape after the last strike, where the minimum daily rate was set at 105 rand per day. Salary entry levels in the public sector approximate to between 5,000 to 8,000 per month. Entry levels in the private sector are much lower, where wages below 1,000 rand a month are recorded. Hence, if we take entry-level wages per sector as a minimum wage level in that sector, then there are already broad-scale discrepancies within sectors themselves. However, coming to the vulnerable sector, Consal has focused specifically in the farm, contract cleaning, and domestic sector, with unions who are representatives in that sector. A basic study carried out by Consal facilitated that four workshops in the Gauteng and Western Cape provinces totaling 120 workers in the farm and domestic sector have recorded the following results. We looked at the average earning of these workers, and the average earning we derived was 2,500 per month between the 120 workers. Average expenses, the most money that workers went into was in traveling. And that, and our comment with regards to that is, this is predominantly an apartheid construct where predominantly black workers living in townships worked away from economic hubs, worked away from so-called white areas or upper-class suburbs in the case of domestic workers. And this resulted in a number of public transport facilities that pays a high premium in terms of transport costs. On average, workers are spending over 500 rand a month just to travel to and from work, and that is almost one a high percentage of their salary. Then we look at that, and especially in the vulnerable sector. If we take the salary of 2,500, Madam Chair, 350 rand per month goes on that. That's an amount we would have to include from the 2,500, which considerably lessens liquidity. Then we look at rent, household, board. It was worked out to an average of 300 rand per worker or per family. Electricity, 200 rand. Fees for fish. And this is another apartheid contract, because workers have to leave their children. Keeping them in a creche is very expensive, and it works around 300 to 500 rand a month. But people in a ballpark figure of 300 rand a month, because that's what they could afford. Households where workers work, especially domestic workers, those households do not welcome children. Farm workers have very limited spaces to ensure the safety of their children. So that's also a huge amount that goes in, goes away from their salaries so that they are allowed to work. We look at water, 200 rand, medicine, and although we've got a figure of 100 rand, But the medicines that they buy, purely basic and symptomatic, for example, it's preventive, for example, flu, medication, painkillers, and so forth. We looked at transport for school, and this is another big dip in the salary. On average, for 2 to 3 children, workers are spending 200 rand a month, which leaves them with 350 rand for food, for clothes, for school fees. After essential expenses, that's what our family is left with. And if we divide this amount with an average family of 6 persons, it works out to 1.90 rand per day per person, which is well below the poverty, international poverty line. We looked at the items that workers and the food they buy, specifically at the items because they do not pay tax. And if we look at just some basic items in that study, you'll find that it adds up to 113 rand out of the 350 rand except for food and other expenses. We look at school uniforms. On every workers are paying 1,000 rand. And many workers cannot afford that amount. They take loans, they stay over months, a good few months, to afford a school uniform, let alone school fees. And then the other big thing we found is that workers are investing towards funeral policies. And that is a must. And if I quote a worker, she says, even if I do not have food, I must have funeral policies. So those are the findings that we've got, that we have experienced from South. And whilst the study, Madam Chair, is not scientifically based, it is more anecdotal. It's just a survey, a simple survey that was conducted with our workers, but it expresses the needs of our workers. It gives one a sense of the level of poverty that exists in the country. And if we combine these figures for both those sectors, we have close to 2 million workers living in poverty and working in poverty. And that is a situation as a confederation we can't accept. Because while workers are working, they continue, their poverty lines, their poverty indices continue to increase. Which means that we are basically a country of the working poor. And if we compute that to statistics, those under regulation like sexual discrimination, we are looking at approximately 3.5 million workers living in that kind of state. We are looking at the vulnerable sectors. We make us then look at Article 3 of Convention 131 again, and it implores us as a country to look at certain elements in determining minimum wages. And these are the need of workers and their families, the general level of wages in the country, the cost of living, social security benefits, and the relative living standards of other social groups, as well as economic factors that will ensure productivity and high levels of unemployment. Those are the elements that we need to look at. And the previous speaker alluded to that. How do we ensure a high productivity level in the country that by implication will also ensure a high level of employment? Right now we have a fragile economy, we are on the downturn, which means that setting a minimum wage, whether nationally, whether at sectoral level, will have to take into account a whole plethora of factors. But coming back to the study, Madam Chair, the basic needs of workers and what they are, that's housing, shelter, food, medical care, education, and transport. These are the factors that we would have to look at when we set the minimum wage. Of concern, again I'm reiterating, food and transport. Therefore, when we set the minimum wage, we will have to look at what pertains with regards to state-sponsored social security. That we found also supplements and complements the earning of workers, especially in the vulnerable sector, and also contributes to the overall income household, especially in those sectors. We term them secondary benefits, low wage earners, especially the farm and domestic sector, fall outside workplace social security net. And in essence, access social grants, which are state sponsored, and which also do or contribute to the household. Now, when we look at the relative living standard that Article 3 pertains to, with regards to other social groups, as well as economic factors that ensure productivity and high levels of employment, in the South African scenario, Madam Chair, we see huge differentials between low and high income earners. As mentioned earlier, differentials between the sectors themselves display a tendency to vastly diverge, and especially from the means set by the sector determination, also as a result of formalized collective bargaining. So the question to ask, why do we want a national minimum wage in South Africa? And what purpose do we want it to serve? As from our unequal vocal voice, that wage regulation of the vulnerable sectors through the mechanism of sectoral determination vastly reduces levels of exploitation in work context of the poorest of the poor. Whilst we may not agree on minimum wage standards as promulgated under these determinations, these determinations are legal tools that afford the worker and union the means to enforce the standard of a minimum wage, as well as basic conditions of service. Whilst the minimum wage standard accepted by these determinations will have little effect on the achievement of substantive equality, it does provide for the standard beyond which no employer may go, which in itself is a baby step towards the achievement of substantive equality. Therefore, it's our contention as a Confederation of South African Workers' Union that the national minimum wage must address both the achievement of substantive equality as envisioned under Section 9 of the Constitution of the Republic, read in conjunction with Section 27, with the specific aim of reducing poverty levels in the country. We will expand on this point later. If we take the standard rate for domestic workers of 2,065.47 rand, and 1,812.57 rand, we find that these rates are slightly above and below the international poverty indicator of $1.25. That's the international indicator at the moment. Translating it into rand, it's 12.93 rand per day, for those rates at March figures. And this works out per member, per full member family in itself. Itself a minimum wage in this sense does not have a significant effect on the reduction of poverty of those employed. However, when viewed in the context of the unemployed, the scenario does look better, as the income generated from such work does provide relief to the families of such workers. However, which in most cases all are supplemented through secondary income sources such as social grants, as indicated above. For the trade unions to translate the needs and aspirations of their members into one ballpark figure that connotes what constitutes a national living wage or a national minimum wage is an onerous task, as there is no scientific basis in calculating subjective notions of our members or what really constitutes their needs. Moreover, when unpacking the elements of both concepts about an element of commonality is envisaged, where the fundamental norm is taken to meet the needs of workers and their families, or remuneration received for a standard work week by a worker in a particular place sufficient to afford a decent standard of living for the worker and his or her family. Before we unpack and crystallize our thinking with regard to the above, we need to look at the notion of what constitutes an average family size in the South African context. While this poses its own challenges, which this paper will not answer, it would suffice to say that an average family size in the South African context does not fit into the mean as envisaged to Western Island. The high percentage of HIV/AIDS orphans, the cultural trend of polygamy, the tendency of migrant workers to hold two or more households, especially during the apartheid era, the high rates of teenage pregnancy, high divorce rate, growing single-parent households, and child-rearing households all compound to challenge the concept. Further, there seems to be no national or international mean instrument that defines or measures as to what constitutes a decent standard of living. In the country, we record wanton and indecent salary disparities between high and low income earners, to the extent it has become a highly emotive issue. Pay disparity is defined as the wage differential between low and high income earners has consistently been a cause of concern for both unions and workers alike, as it is the single most emotive criterion in defining inequality in the country. Service delivery and labor strikes bear testimony to this. How then do we unpack the notion of a decent standard of living when on the one hand we have a domestic worker with a take-home pay of 2,000 as opposed to a CEO with a monthly package in excess of 1 million? Even if we take the national average earning per month of 14,911 rand, the average median in the country, it simply means that close to half the workforce is earning an average median wage of less than 2,800 a month. Therefore, in terms of the public, it becomes difficult to contextualize in real terms what would constitute a decent standard of living in the country. However, a starting point in the dialogue, what would constitute a decent standard of living in our interactions with workers, the following criteria are derived to give us a sense of a decent standard of living is that they state that at a very basic level, they need an income for clothes and toiletry, to keep clean and to protect against weather elements, electricity, gas, husband, to cook food and to provide lights, water for drinking, cleaning and household purposes, proper houses for shelter with good sanitation, proper food, at least 2 meals a day, education for the children which allows them to break out of the poverty cycle, transport to and from work for workers and to and from school for children, medicine and hospital care. In no way, Madam Chair, does the above criteria give resonation to a definition of what constitutes a decent standard of living, as this is only a statement of needs as expressed by our members. If we take food as an example, what criteria do you apply to cost what it would take to keep a person healthy, where the variables themselves translate into age, sex, level of activity, nature of job, height, demographic, etc. If we use battery food as an indicator of healthy food, then the rising cost of food and other services and consumables attached to the production of such food do not drive a static indicator of cost of living expenses. Hence, by the very nature, the variable of cost of living becomes an inconsistent variable in the formulation of what constitutes a decent standard of living. Another presumption that attaches to the argument above is that as cost of living expenses rise, by implication then, there would be a need to adjust what is deemed to be the national minimum wage. Therefore, it is contended that a national minimum wage cannot by its very nature be a constant as an indicator of poverty reduction. The national minimum wage concept would have to be supported by other variables, such as social security, social assistance measures to ensure a more holistic approach to reduction and improved standard of living. Our conclusions and the way forward, Madam Chair. The impact of sexual determinators, and I'll discuss this first. The thinking behind the promulgation of sexual determinations was a major step in regulating the work, the wage of the working poor. And we applaud government for that, particularly the vulnerable sector. Whether or not sexual determinations have had an impact in reducing the level of poverty in the country is a matter open to dialogue. However, what is important is that these determinations, by their very legal nature and content, not only enforce minimum rates of pay, but conditions of service as well, thereby setting minimum standards of work as informed by the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. These instruments have been active currently for 10 years, and the effect thereof is not consistent with the prediction of large-scale unemployment after the promulgation and enforcement of these determinations. Still, there is also an element of caution in that if minimum wages are set too high for private households in the domestic sector, farm enterprises, contract training, and others be able to absorb such increase given the current state of economy.
However, the effect of minimum wages as set by the determination may have the following effect. If wages are set above the poverty line, it may mean that households of such workers may be lifted out of the poverty line index, assuming there is one wage earner or more. However, research studies do point to the fact that poorer households are larger, as indicated above. Therefore, the impact of an increase to above the poverty line may have little or no effect. Secondly, given the huge discrepancies between the median wage, the national median wage of $2,800 and the average working wage earning of $14,911, the challenge that presents itself is how do we decrease the wage differential that favors the progressive achievement of substantive equality. If we are to read this in the context of Section 9 and 27 of the Constitution, if we take the median wage between the two figures, that's 14,911 minus 2,800, we come up with a figure of 12,811, and divide that by 2, and we come up with a ballpark figure of 6,405. We ask this question, would this be a realistic and achievable norm for the vulnerable sector, especially the farm and domestic sector? Would this not lead to largely unemployment and workers would be priced out of the labor market? So we are cautious when we are looking at these figures. Thirdly, if we take the minimum wage to above these qualifiers, as by SASA, and the qualifiers I'm talking about is that if we take the minimum wage in terms of social grants and accessibility to the social grants, there are certain criteria that are used to ensure that the people who are within a certain income group or low income group to access these grants. Now, if we set the minimum wage to above these qualifiers, what would be the impact in terms of the social grants? For example, if we take a transport grant, it is accessed by over 11 million Rwandans, right? And if we then look at the criteria, a single parent who earns less than R39,600, a married couple earning a combined income of R79,200 may access these transport grants. If the minimum wage is above that, and what would the impact then be in terms of the secondary benefit or social security net that government has put in place? Does this follow it? If it does follow it, then what would the impact, further impact be? We look at the minimum wage. If we set the minimum wage to around $3,500 on gross earnings per month, and the plan translates to $42,000 a year, if we look at households and number of persons of households, and we divide that, simple tax calculation, 3,500 divided by 30 will translate to 116 rand per person per day. So we divide that by 4, 29 rand point 16 cents per day per person, which is slightly above the poverty. If you go down further, in a household of 6 people, 19 rand and 44 cents per day. And then if we take it to 8 people, 40.56 cents per day, which brings it almost on the poverty line, depending on the exchange rate. This means that while households may be lifted out of the poverty line index, does it mean that they have now ensured, does it mean that now a decent standard of living potential has been achieved? Obviously, the concept is far more complicated than the simple calculation. And then one also sees the negative impact, the progressive negative impact on these computations, especially with large households and the equivalent or the relationship to the poverty line index. Clearly, we need to find out from government in terms of if we set the minimum wage, what would the impact be on the qualifiers as set by SASA? How would the impact on households? Because if we look, just a simple example, if we look at some of the income, your grandparents will be in a household, the grandparents will be having income from SASA, foster, if the household has foster children, the foster children will be earning an income. If the household qualifies for child care support, they will access that as well. So we need to also have an understanding of how the social assistance or the grant system impacts the household income. We look at the impact of social security. I've discussed that. Section 27(1) of the Constitution makes provision for socioeconomic rights, such as health care, food, water, social security. Now, if you look at the social security and how it's impacting, we look at close to 16,642,643 persons receive social grants. Of that, 11,703,165 recipients, and that's the bulk of our social security net that goes into child support. And if we compute that to the maximum of 6 children per family, it gives an income of 1,980 per family. So that also has an impact in terms of how we need to look at the other factors or the other variables that we need to look at in computing or looking at the minimum wage. The question then arises, Madam Chair, do we consider the supplementary value of such grants and benefits on household income? Secondly, do we separate state security sponsorship, welfare contributions when we're considering the minimum wage? Thirdly, do we separate social security measures such as housing and medical care from any calculation of the minimum wage? So how then do we factor what the state sponsors and then what employer, what is the responsibility of the employer as well? And lastly, we look at low-cost housing, no-fee schools, free medical care. What do these contribute to the alleviation of poverty for low-income earners who are largely dependent on these benefits? How do these investments then contribute to ensure a decent standard of living from the side of the state? However, Madam Chair, we, as for SAO, we are looking also at the construction of what we call a care economy. And this is a major concern in that a large percentage of the vulnerable sector constitutes women. Given their political, cultural, and economic oppression, both past and current, how do we address the question of inherent gender inequalities systemic in the world of work? How do we create spaces for women to access economic opportunity that will cause the advancement of the cycle of poverty? The care economy that we envisage is sensitive to the needs of women, and how would these needs be actualized in the workplace? If we look at Articles 4 and 5 of the Convention on the Workers with Travel Responsibility, 4 makes it very clear, with a view to creating effective equality of opportunity and treatment for men and women, all measures compatible with national conditions and possibilities shall be taken to enable workers with families to exercise their right to free choice of employment and to take into account of their needs in terms of conditions of employment and in social security. All measures compatible with national conditions and possibilities shall further be taken to take into account the needs of workers with family responsibilities in community planning and to develop or promote community services, public or private, such as childcare and family services and facilities. Whilst CONSAO is cognizant of the fact that this convention has not been ratified by government, the above articles do resonate with Section 27 of the Constitution of the socioeconomic rights enshrined in the Constitution, and this in conjunction with Section 9. Therefore, we propose as a first step we take cognizance of the provisioning of the following amenities in communities. The qualitative provisioning of low-fee schools that shall be located in communities where the needs are greatest in improving access to education. Improved access to primary health care centers that provide services which take into account family health, primary health, family planning, BCG services, mental health. It is envisaged that the human resource provisioning with regards to doctor-patient and nurse-patient ratio be progressively reduced to ensure timely treatment and quality service delivery. Develop youth, child and youth care community centers that promote support, guidance and counseling, library services, creche facilities that reduces the burden of after-school care on working parents. It also envisages that early childhood development be one of the focal areas of attention at such centers. The intention and purpose of such centers should be to promote healthy lifestyles and choices for the youth, yet providing a safe haven for the children while the parents guard their siblings' work. We see a cohesion between government, employers, employer organizations, and worker organizations in ensuring the promotion and success of such centers. It is our contention as the South African Workers Union that if we are to achieve the notion of substantive equality, then we need to level the playing field, equal opportunity and equal treatment at the most basic but most important level of our communities, and that is the family unit. Therefore, it is submitted that meaningful and substantive change would be quantifiable and justifiable if any investment in communities are developed. Consolidated proposals that before we make the pronouncement on what would constitute a minimum wage of the sector, a qualitative and quantitative analysis needs to be conducted on the impact of state-sponsored social assistance, security and the reduction of poverty, not only in this sector but also in households where no one is employed, as the impact of a minimum wage standard may influence employment rate in the sector. An assessment of the needs of communities, commencing with the poorest of the poor, with regards to the provisioning of basic utilities and services, the development and creation of social security funds that offers long-term relief for the unemployed. Finally, Madam Chair, in conclusion, we, the Confederation of South African Workers Union, place on record our sincere gratitude to the Portfolio Committee for having invited us to make this presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Members of the committee, public, any questions or additions registered to members, Honorable Lee?
Thank you again. If we can just get that presentation, please. We don't have it, so we have to just listen while you speak and try and make comments and so on that. I think it's a useful presentation. You looked at possible numbers sort of from a lay perspective. Obviously, the two different issues, affordability of the economy and the needs of workers for basic needs. I think that's going to be an agreement, or at least you've tried to give some thought to that, quite a lot of thought. So I just appreciate the presentation. Thank you very much. But if we can at least have a copy of it, we can read it again after this.
Thank you, Honorable. Understand all the presentations that we don't have a committee secretary has any more written questions or contributions. In the absence of hands, anybody who wants to say anything about national minimum wage before we conclude the agenda of today, anything now you can talk, whatever you want to say about the national minimum wage. The hand that was up was from the Deputy Chair of Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another contribution I'd like to make from an HR perspective, which I find both when I work in corporate as well as with my current clients. They tend to have, especially within manufacturing, etc., they tend to have lots of overtime. And I see, and the reason I'm going with this is overtime obviously needs to be paid at times 1.5. And they often say, you know, they have difficulty paying people more money, etc., etc. And my suggestion there is there's a huge gap if you look at their budget in terms of what they pay in terms of overtime, but if they actually create more employment and rather paying people a better wage, working fewer hours and have more people employed. For example, instead of having people work overtime 12 hours a day, have no shifts longer than 8 hours, including a lunch break, whichever way you want to do that lunch break, 1 hour lunch or half an hour lunch with 2 tea breaks of 15 minutes each, and instead of rather an additional shift. That way, not only do you create more employment opportunities, but there's also been research that I've done from the data that I collected from clients where there's actually an increase in productivity, which also allows my clients to have actually expanded in terms of their business. And in doing so, obviously, we need more profitability. So that way, putting bread on more people's tables, so creating employment one, through creating increasing productivity by letting people not work such long hours, because now you increase the risk of machinery or damage, people getting burned out, high sick, absenteeism, etc. And all those fears are significantly reduced by looking at the simple things such as overtime, creating more shifts, and creating more employment. And then in doing so, then allowing them to have the opportunity to pay the people a higher wage as opposed to the one that they had previously. So, thank you.
And the lady behind. My name is Sharon from Lumka. Thank you. I love the presentations, especially your quantitative analysis with the 30 days, and then you divided it by a failure of 4, 6 of 8. So I just took the Marikana 12,500 that the miners were striking for, and just also did some calculations as you were presenting. So I just found that with the average of family of 4, I found 104.116 per day. Of 6 is 69.44, and then by 8 is 58.0832. So dividing with the 3, the average is still 75.229 per day, which is way above the poverty line, which is still above the poverty line and still a decent amount for the day. So yeah, I just love quantitative analysis, so it just gave me something to do. So maybe things that we'll use later on while we're looking at our rates, comparing it to whether what we had came up with was actually realistic to what's required, was this commission to just make sure they reach conclusion and they get to the right requirement for a national minimum wage. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon. And any other hand? Ms. Kuntwana.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to thank this opportunity to thank the Labour Committee to give us an opportunity to come and raise our views. I'm Ms. Sintona from Gugulethu, owner of a small catering company, which is Okana Catering. Sometimes you tend to own a business, opening a business, just to try and resist the issue of unemployment. And this day for me, it's just a special day because this minimum wage, when it's been decided in Parliament, the law is going to be passed and it's going to be implemented, it's going to affect even the small businesses that are within the locations. And for us to come here today and raise views and try to put out how we're running the small businesses, some of these small businesses are grand because we want to make profit. We're trying to run the small businesses as to create employment for especially women in the location, especially when it's actually come to my business, the kind of business that I'm doing in Google 2018 skills. It just needs women. And when we get an opportunity to get that catering, we prepare the food because we know how to prepare the food, and especially for a lot of people, so to us, then it's not a challenge. It can be a challenge to someone else, but for us it's not a challenge. And at the end of the day, it makes you to sleep well at home because somebody has an opportunity to put food on his table without having a scheme that is being required. It's unfortunate that the gentleman from the fishing industry doesn't have any presentation, because when he tried to mention that there are businesses that are run without even a budget that you can come about, but you have at the back of your mind that I'm running this business just for the sake of the people that are within my surroundings. Professionally, I'm a teacher, but I've resigned, and I try to create this business just to redress the problem of unemployment. And this kind of business that I'm running, it's a business that you can have today and tomorrow you can't have business, which means people are sitting and have nothing to do. And to the chair, to the chair of the Labor Department, I wish when you take decisions, when it comes, I know this is going to be very difficult and be very hard for the committee to consider small businesses like the business that I've mentioned now. But I know at the end of the day, when the laws are passed, it's going to affect small businesses I'm talking about. But I wish when we are making these decisions, we can go down and look deep down at their businesses that are being treated as to give employment to people that are sitting with nothing to do at the end of the day. And if it's possible for the committee to make a reservation and consider those kinds of businesses, I don't know how I'm going to make this possible. If there's just a small little room that you can create and make exceptionals when you are deciding on this minimum wage, because when it's been decided, it's going to be decided and it's going to be final. It's going to affect each and every business that it's been known as a registered business. But I'm making this plea to the committee that there are businesses that are being created, not the benefit of making profit, but just being created just to have people working, people have something to do with them, creating. You know, I don't know how can I explain this, but just having people who can have something to end at the end of the day and make a living. I thank you.
Thank you, Ma Tona. Any more? Let's finish with the comment. Ma'am, back.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm Melanie Roy from NUNSA, and just a few points that we want to raise that we would appreciate it if would be taken note of this. And as we've seen all the relevant presentations, what we can take from this is that we know that the national minimum wage must be such that it increases the standard of living of people, and that people must be better off, not worse off. And I'm going to note that it must be inclusive of a social package, so it should be living wage. Also, each sector should be looked at based on merit. Like you've seen the fishing and the agriculture, certain aspects affect them solely. And if you look at the seasonal incomes, I mean, their income is based on seasonal activity. So when looking at the different sectors, we should look at each one's individual experiences. And as you said earlier, Madam Chair, that we should come back with the experience that affect us directly and affect our sectors directly, affects our workers' lives directly. So it's important that when we leave from this, that we look at our aim of making workers' lives better. Thank you.
Thank you, Rosa. Any more hands from the public before members have noted you? Since I've started this side, let me finish on the side. There's a hand there. Can you see it, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sudadi, UCT. I just want to add to the last, what the comments that the last speaker made, and also to turn to the speaker from Limpopo. And I think what is relevant to this discussion is also the whole question of job security. what the contributor from Limpopo had to say basically is that if you increase this minimum wage beyond a certain level, then workers get kicked out of the system. So dealing with an economy that actually abhors or hates certain levels of wages, you get kicked out of the system. And in this respect, I think this system has not changed over the past 100 years. So there's a problem with the economic system that feel that we're not addressing. I think it's important to consider the social package, not just to look at a number. It is good that the AHI introduced this notion of the economy as an organism. I don't think that this organism is necessarily a virtuous one. And perhaps the solution needs to address that issue. Why, over such an extended period of time, do we still have this vast differential between what the lowest paid and what the highest paid earn? Within the South African context, if you look at immigration firms, then on average, whites still earn 8 times what blacks earn. I also want to make a comment about an area of employment, and this relates to government, when it comes to community health workers. I think very close to the domestic worker situations. These workers are not covered by any sectoral determination. They play quite a vital role as ancillary health workers in the national health system, public health system, but they have no security of employment. They are not represented in the collective bargaining structures amongst public workers as well. So I assume that there will be some introspection when it comes to the vulnerable workers, the atypical workers. There are many in government's employ as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. Any more help from the members of the public? None from our stakeholders. Honorable Rollins.
Thanks, Chair. The last comment from my side was actually a question. I just wanted to follow up to the lady from Kubilevja. I'm sorry, ma'am, I didn't get your name. But the question is, you seem to indicate that you were suggesting that you want an exemption for job creation initiatives of some sort. Have you got a proposal? I don't mean long term, but just have you got a proposal that we could consider? Or what specifically do you think we should do?
I can draft the proposal and present to the Secretary.
Anything that you wish to say, members, before we conclude?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what the lady is saying from Google later, and I would like to agree, there's lots of legislation that is around small businesses, and I agree that maybe small businesses should be exempted, for example, within, say, couple of R1 million profit per annum, not to necessarily comply as yet. But as the business grow in terms of productivity and profitability and become more sustainable, so one, that they can create more employment and then also gradually increase it. As I mentioned earlier, we'll probably have a system where we can incrementally increase salaries. In the corporates, we generally use a concept called compo ratio, and it basically says that twice a year, those salaries that are out of line in terms of market-related salaries, you actually need to focus on them and ensure that there's budget for those salaries specifically, as opposed to maybe looking at the higher earners and then give them specific focus and ensure that it is reached within a certain period of time. In addition to that, I would like to caution, especially with in terms of corporate success, you'll often find that someone will sabotage you. So fortunately for me, being at the senior HR level, I also make sure that I adjust company policies, practices and procedures and include in senior senior managers and all management part of a performance agreement that they would adhere to that. Because if you do not put systems in place, the whole project, which is a great idea, now falls to pieces. So now I ensure that it's adhered to. One, you sorry, the best way to eat someone is the best. So sadly, so you need to put systems in place in terms of management performance reviews, which is where the salaries and performance agreement and bonuses are based on, to ensure that they adhere to it, as well as ensure that you adjust on an ongoing basis HR policies, practices and procedures to ensure adherence to that, and ensure that there is timeliness, procedures taken or action taken or corrective action more specifically taken against those who are not adhering to the process, because there's nothing worse than having, which we do have in South Africa, the best of legislations and etc. and laws, but there's often a lack of implementation and follow-through. And people get away with it because there are not effective monitoring systems put in place to deal with it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any more hands? Let me use this opportunity to thank all of you by coming and share your views with Parliament. As we have already said from the beginning, that your views are important to this committee. They are important for the process that we have embarked on. And we are sure that the product that will come out should be in a position to address the issues that are raised. However, there are a number of issues that are raised. The national minimum wage, it does, though we have not yet formulated or agreed on a definition of national minimum wage that we are talking about at all, it will differ from country to country depending to what they want to achieve at the end of the day. Definitely dealing with basic needs of people, certain things will be taken into consideration. But we are definitely not talking about completely reduction of poverty. It can be, but it will have to make a dent. It will have to afford people to take kids to school. It will have to afford people to have a decent meal of food. It will have to afford people to, you know, to do a number of things that they are. When we went around in these provinces, listening to workers themselves, they narrated very sad and serious stories that they do go to work, but by the end of the month, those who are paid the month end or those who are paid weekly, it's difficult to go home because you have nothing to bring at home. Nothing at all. There is no difference. You pay for the transport. The money is just paid for transport. For the accommodation that some of you were talking about, farm workers, people are not even in a position to go home, those who are from in other provinces. So those are things that must be taken into consideration, and many others. And definitely, the national minimum wage is not aimed at crippling our economy or making business people not to have business. You will need business, you need workers as well. But all those parties, at least they must be in a position to live like human beings, not like this. So that's the major issue, or that is among the major things. Thank you very much for your support, because you take great you will not waste your money. And no, that we are not all thinking in the same way, which is accepted, because if you are all your views, there will be those who will be not for it, for reasons that they will advance. And it's not that must be accepted, because we are people who have views, who are running different businesses,
but let's hear you. You know, so thank you so much once more, and thank you for the members, and the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.